This show about load balancing services for any sort of IT infrastructure was sponsored by Avi Networks, and they have a special offer for you. Visit info.avinetworks.com/packetpushers and sign up for a free Beyond Application Delivery as a Service t-shirt. Go ahead, think through the acronym. Beyond Application Delivery as a Service. I'll wait right here. You got it? Ah, you got it. Okay, cool. So if you want one of those shirts, head on up to info.avinetworks.com/packetpushers. And now on with the show. How do you get load balancing done when your load balancer is no longer this single great big appliance or cluster that you carefully and lovingly manage and build server pools and virtual IPs one at a time? Some of you are going, wait a minute, the world's changed and we don't do it that way anymore because I totally just finished a ticket this morning doing exactly that. Yeah, of course, many of you do still manage your load balancers in this way, but honestly, that is not the long-term future of load balancing. It can't be. It can't be that way for any IT infrastructure in the long haul. Applications need to get stood up and shut back down in lockstep with load balancing services on demand, on the fly, in response to customer demand, in response to developer needs. Avi Networks joins the Packet Pushers as a new sponsor today to share how load balancing in the modern era gets done. And joining us from Avi is Guru Chahal. Guru, welcome to Packet Pushers. And if you would, please introduce yourself to the audience.
Thanks for having us, guys. My name is Guru. I lead product management here at Avi Networks, and I'm very excited to represent a fantastic team of technologists that are pushing the boundaries on what load balancing can be and should be in this day and age today.
Now, I think I first ran into Avi. You guys had a booth up at Cisco Live, and I had a chance to sit and chat with you and understand a little bit about what's different. And one of the things you emphasized to me as I was chatting with you folks is that the way modern software is being deployed, things are different than the way we have been. We were maybe standing up a virtual IP in front of a pool that would have monolithic services sitting behind it. You mentioned a lot of services now are deployed in the cloud or in a hybrid cloud environment. And microservices, even though not everybody's doing it, a lot of people are. That's more and more meaningful. And load balancing is having to adjust to those trends. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. There's three big trends that are fundamentally reshaping how we think about networks in general, but even within networks, load balancing and network services in particular. The first one is where it all starts. It's always about the application, right? It's never about the infrastructure necessarily, but about how we support applications. And we've all seen the evolution of applications going from monoliths to perhaps three-tier architectures where a web tier talks to an app tier, talks to DB in the back, to now a more service-centric architecture where, you know, when I go to Amazon.com, the retail store, there's probably something like 100 to 200 services or quote-unquote applications that work together, that are calling out to each other to generate that single web page that I see on the front end. So this rapid change in application architectures from monoliths to more distributed applications that can scale out in real time, scale back in real time, and so on, that's the first big trend we are seeing over the last 5+ years or so. The second big trend is location. Where we used to run an application was so predictable. You could walk into a data center and ask someone, where's SharePoint? And they could point to the exact rack, the exact server, walk into Amazon or Facebook's data center and say, where's Facebook.com running? And they're going to laugh at you because the location of where an application is running has fundamentally abstracted itself out from the infrastructure itself. So it could be on-prem, it could be in a colo, it could be out in the public cloud, it could be moving around. Our customers are no longer comfortable tying down the location of an application for the long term. They want to use technologies that allow the application to move around as need be. So that's the second thing that's changing. And the third thing is more about expectations. You know, about 10 years ago, something really interesting happened in the server world with virtualization. Server admins were certainly the new heroes where instead of taking weeks and weeks and weeks to get you compute, they could now spin up a virtual machine almost on demand and give you access to virtual machines and compute effectively in a matter of seconds or minutes. But that same revolution didn't really quite make its way down to the network, where network provisioning was never quite as quick as application owners and lines of businesses would want. So this notion of expectations has changed significantly. There's an expectation that the network can be provisioned instantly. There's an expectation that when I'm ready to roll out an application, the load balancer, of course, it's going to be there and it's going to be provisioned in seconds. There's an expectation that when my needs change, when the demands on an application change, the load balancers are going to be able to respond to that. So there's very little patience, near instantaneous response from the load balancing infrastructure. That expectation has changed big time. So those are the three big changes.
I think there's an additional thing here is that enterprise IT may not be doing that today, but it certainly knows that it needs to be doing it very soon. The things that we see happening in the public cloud are also coming into the private cloud. This idea of rapid provisioning, click a button, and the whole thing happens. It's not something that you're doing today, but it will be something you're going to be doing very soon. So even if you're listening to this and going, oh, that's not something that I'm doing, the reality is that you will be doing that very soon, and you need to start thinking about how you're going to solve that, I think.
Yeah, God, I mean, that's so true, right? As Greg, I used to talk about this concept of a public scorecard. For the longest time in IT, there was no way to compare how do my services in networks or infrastructure compare to the next guy down the street. But now AWS and other public clouds have a public scorecard. I can provision load balancing for you in X seconds for Y cost. It's right there. And CIOs are looking at it and saying, how do we compare to this guy's? And so enterprise IT is forced to respond to that public scorecard. It's driving such a massive change on how we manage our infrastructure and what kind of technologies we're bringing into our data centers.
So I want to follow up on that. We mentioned the microservices earlier. You mentioned applications getting broken up from monoliths into multi-tier, which of course is pretty common. But then microservices, is that actually a trend that we are likely to see as well?
I do believe that. Now, if you remember about 10, 15 years ago, there was all this talk about service-oriented architectures. So the notion of distributing applications into manageable, independently scalable, and deployable components has been around for a while. The challenge back then was it was a very heavy-duty investment. So yes, Amazon.com could go out and invest in that and have a very microservices or service-oriented architecture in place. But the regular mom-and-pop IT shop found it incredibly hard to deploy those architectures. Now the harness around with containerization, with a number of other CI/CD technologies, et cetera, with the increased ability to publish and utilize APIs, the fundamental building blocks of more easily rolling out microservices are there now. And I think that's driving a considerable change in how we design applications and roll out applications. So that's a trend that's going to continue to happen. But like with anything else, I don't want to overstep and project that this is a transition that's going to happen instantaneously. These are 5 to 10 year long transitions. So we will continue to deploy web servers and app servers and databases. But at the same time, very gradually, as applications undergo refreshes and refactoring, they will get refactored into more distributed architectures with microservices in play.
What's really interesting here is you think about, sure, microservices is long term, but even now as certain applications start getting broken up into smaller services at whatever level where it makes sense, maybe not to break up everything, and maybe some apps don't even map that well to it, but as you do break them up, that affects your scaling ability because now you can take a particular service and scale it if it's the thing that's the bottleneck rather than having to worry about the entirety of the application being scaled. You can scale a little bit at a time. But it also creates application interdependencies where now an app delivering a transaction to a user has got a whole series of sub-level services that must be functioning in order to deliver that transaction in a timely fashion. And so when you scale, you might not have to scale everything, but you may need to scale one subcomponent. Okay. We also mentioned here, you said the trend of being tolerant of a long provisioning cycle to actually bring a service up. People just aren't going to tolerate that. It's got to be ready and up and running and done quickly. Waiting forever and ever for an application to come online is no longer acceptable. So all of these things kind of dovetail into the point I want to make here, which is we've got to start automating the provisioning of a lot of these services. Doing them all by hand, one at a time, isn't viable for the future. So how do we get to that point, particularly in load balancing services where that's an automated thing instead of this long, lengthy whiteboard discussion where we try to figure out exactly how to stand the service up?
That's a great point. And, you know, back in the day, if you had a few dozen applications that you were managing and you took a week to provision a load balancer for those, that was probably okay because you were doing load balancer provisioning maybe once a month or once every few weeks and otherwise just, you know, it's sort of fire and forget. But as the application architectures change, you're forced to go back to that well again and again and again. You're forced to go back to the load balancer and create virtual services and VIPs and provision new applications and services and adjust them for rapid scaling up and down and troubleshooting and so on. And so the need for that provisioning cycle to be near instantaneous is extremely high. And that's really what's driving the interest in Avi. I'll share with you another example. About a year after we started Avi, this is about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I went over to New York and met up with a friend of mine who runs infrastructure at one of the largest banks in the States. And I said, what have you been up to? And he said, we're building a private cloud. And he was very proud of this. They'd spent probably between $5 to $10 million on that project at that point. And I said, everybody defines cloud differently. Tell me what yours means. And he says, think of it, Guru, as a big VM vending machine. You can walk up to it and a developer says, give me 4 VMs of this type and this OS running on top. And they press a button and boom, this thing spits those out in 30 seconds. And he was very proud of it. And I said, what happens next? He said, well, the developer can run whatever they want on this infrastructure. And I said, that's great. And then what happens next? And he says, well, then they file a ticket to provision a load balancer so they can bring the application online. And I was like, Andy, how long does that take? And I said, about 6 weeks. And I just laughed. You just spend millions and millions of dollars on the VM vending machine experience. And then, of course, you're twiddling your thumbs for 6 weeks to get the load balancer provision. And that was a genesis of the problem we're trying to solve. So how do you increase the agility and reduce the provisioning cycle for load balancers in this day and age when the expectations have changed? The expectations are, I get my VMs instantly, I get my application instantly, and then I can connect it to the external world and see what happens.
Part of that is just smaller load balancers is going to be my guess here. You correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've been used to in so many enterprises is this huge investment in huge load balancers where everything is running through, you know, a few sets of massive load balancers doing tons and tons of transactions. And so there's so much fear that if you mess around with that thing too much, something's going to go bad. And it's going to affect all these applications. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's all this process built around it.
One big load balancer becomes an enormous challenge to keep running, doesn't it?
The big ivory tower of load balancer, right? It's like, you provision an application, you file a ticket, then you go to this big load balancer, you sit in front of it, you pray, you bow down a few times, and then you hope to God it works. And if you think about it, if I ask you as a technologist, would you design load balancers that way? And you'd say, heck, absolutely not. And then I ask you, how would you design it? And you say, you know what? I'd have lots and lots of tiny load balancers, perhaps even per application load balancers, or certainly per tenant load balancers. So my risk is less. The blast radius of getting things wrong is less. I would never do this, you know, massive mainframe-like load balancer in the middle. And then I'd ask you, well, why don't you? And the answer is, well, it's because it's impossible to manage hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of appliances in my environment.
That is what everyone listening to this show is thinking right now. Yes, I have a few because at least I have a single point of management or just a few small number of points of management to go after those things.
Right. And if you think about it, that's such a crazy answer because 20, 30 years ago, guys in storage have already solved this problem. If you think about it, in storage, you manage arrays. You don't manage a drive. You don't go to every drive and say, boy, this drive is full and that drive is empty. Let me move things around and create space. You don't do that. So this problem of central management and yet discrete individual components that provide the service, this problem has been solved in other parts of infrastructure years ago. In fact, even in compute, with the rise of converged infrastructure, people have, for the most part, in a lot of environments, stopped managing individual servers and started thinking about compute as a single fluid capacity pool. And yet in networks, and certainly in load balancers, we're unable to do that. And that's really where Avi got started. And we asked ourselves, how can we move away from this one massive appliance or an appliance-based architecture to a distributed fabric that can be rolled out, that can offer per app, per tenant load balancing services to everything from traditional applications to next generation applications, to containers, to applications running in public cloud. So no matter where the app is running, how do I provide services, its own load balancer to that application, while never taking on the burden of having to manage thousands of load balancers? Also a centrally managed fabric of load balancers that can instantly scale up, scale down, provide services wherever the application goes, and can be provisioned in seconds. That's really the challenge we took on and started shipping several years ago. That's a business we've built quite successfully over the last couple of years that we are very excited about.
Help me understand here. Am I managing, like if I manage a cluster of load balancers, physical appliances, I would manage that through whatever the interface is and assign virtual IPs and pool members and that kind of thing. Is it this kind of a thing, only the cluster members have been virtualized, or is it something more sophisticated?
something much more sophisticated. I mean, think about a single elastic load balancer, an Amazon-like experience where the entire fabric, the entire load balancing estate that you have just has a single control point, a single management point. We talk about this example all the time, mostly because everyone knows about it, but think about a Cat 6K, the grand old daddy of a data center switching. Think about a switch like that. You don't manage line cards, you manage a single device, and it can have one line card or two or eight or, you know, whatever the size of that chassis might be. Think of our fabric as a massive virtual chassis. You can have one load balancer, two load balancers, or thousands of load balancers, maybe virtual, maybe containerized, maybe appliances, but you manage them centrally as if it was one massive elastic load balancer. So when you want to provision a VIP, when you want to provision a VS, when you want to add a pool server, you always go to a single place. You go there, you provision your application, and then perhaps add servers, remove servers, make changes to load balancing algorithms, all in a central place. And the system takes care of where to send that request, which load balancer to actually tweak in response to that.
Ah, so by which load balancer? Are we still talking about physical appliances then, or virtual ones, or both?
We're a software company. You can instantiate that software as is most appropriate for your environment. So our customers from the same central management point will instantiate hardware load balancers, so appliance load balances, with our software running on standard x86, which is useful in a lot of environments. Or they will spin us up as the actual load balancers up as virtual machines or even containers. And this can be all on-prem or in the public cloud. So this is truly a massive global fabric that can be instantiated as bare metal, virtual machine, or container anywhere your application goes.
So let's just hook onto that then. I think that's important because a lot of people are still focused on the device. Your load balancing instances, let's just put together a solution. You've got load balancing instances that can be bare metal, VMs, or containers.
That's right. We call those service engines.
Right. So they're service engines and they actually do, you know, pack it in, pack it out, choose where it's going to go, classic yep. load balancing. And then above that, you've got some software that then organizes the configurations of all those devices, right? We talked before about how the configuration of managing dozens of devices in a data center would be a problem. But what you said was that the centralized configuration takes away that. Maybe you could delve into that a little bit more.
Yeah, so two components to our architecture, the service engines, which is the, think of that as the load balancer, of course, packet in, packet out, and the central brain, which we call, as the name suggests, it's called a controller. And so the centralized controller is the policy repository and the single point of management and control for the entire fabric. By doing this, what this enables our customers to do is go over to a single place for all configuration, go over to a single place for all monitoring of the hundreds of service engines they might have in their environment, and go to a single place for all automation. I mean, imagine how difficult automation is when the first thing your automation scripts have to do is, which load balancer do I go and configure this for? Instead of that, all your automation is, again, against this 100% REST API on an AVI controller, and then the controller, in turn, injects policy out into the appropriate service engine.
The whole thing about managing a fleet of load balancers, I like to say fleet because it, you know, gives yeah. you this idea of lots of little boats in a flotilla, is actually not that hard. The reason that we have one load balancer is partly because of the configuration, but the real reason is because of routing.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one way out of the data center, but you can still solve that in your configuration. That's not a specific issue. It's just a tradition, isn't it?
That's exactly right. You know, Chandra gives us, one of the guys here on our team, gives this example all the time, and I really like this example. It's the example of an air traffic controller. So think of our controller as an air traffic controller at an airport. When you want to take an action as the airport manager, perhaps shut down a runway, make a change, and so on, you don't go to individual aircrafts and tell them what to do. You just give a call into the ATC, and the air traffic controller takes care of that from there. They'll call the right aircraft. They'll make the changes. They'll tell them how to route their flight paths, where to land, what to do. And all of that complexity of managing this entire fleet of aircraft is removed from you. All you had was a very declarative intention, said, I want to shut down runway X. The ATC takes care of the rest. And we are the same way. When the enterprise IT team wants to make a particular decision saying, we want to provision more capacity, we want to provision more applications, whatever that might be, they go to the controller and the controller then takes care of the rest. It might spin up more service engines, spin them down. It might move VIPs around. It might take any of these individual actions without exposing that complexity of managing hundreds of service engines or hundreds of load balancers to the IT team.
You describe a service engine and you just mentioned this auto-scaling feature. So when you're talking about autoscaling, you're talking about autoscaling service for a specific VIP that maybe is getting hit pretty hard, or the system as an aggregate needing more service engines to handle the transactional spread across however many virtual IPs are being serviced?
Both. We think about the ability to autoscale your infrastructure as something you should be able to do both on a per application basis, but also as an infrastructure team. So let me peel this out a little bit and give you two examples. A very simple example could be you've deployed our controller, you've deployed perhaps 4 service engines into your environment, and now you're deploying applications more. And one day those service engines are going to run out of capacity and you're continuing to deploy more applications on the controller. And at some point, the controller says, you know what, I don't have any more capacity. At that point, the controller can go out, talk to perhaps a vCenter or OpenStack or AWS or wherever that application might be. It'll talk to the management and orchestration system in that environment, spin up more service engines so it can bring more capacity online from a load balancing perspective, and then start placing applications onto the service engines. So that's what I call truly increasing your load balancing scaling capabilities in real time. And then there will come a day when an individual application is getting hit so hard that it needs more than what a single load balancer can offer. And at that point, we can even autoscale that single application where we can spin up more service engines and have all of those work jointly together to meet the needs of this application in real time. We can also do a third thing, which is send out the appropriate signals to your management and orchestration systems so that you can bring more instances of the application online, right? So if you have 4 load balancers or 10 load balancers in that server pool, we can send you the appropriate signal thanks to the telemetry we collect internally saying, you know what, 10 web servers is not enough. Your web servers are keeling over. They're about to die. You need to bring on board at least 3 more. So we can send out these signals. And in response to those, of course, you can then bring on board more web servers.
It all depends on where the bottleneck is. If the bottleneck's on the front end and ingestion, then you need to scale up more service engines. If it's on the back end, then right, no amount of additional service engines is going to help you if the servers on the back end are choked serving up the app. Yeah.
Yeah. And this brings me to something we haven't talked about yet, but really important. How do you even identify that? How do you identify in a network where your problem lies? That stuff is just so hard. In fact, you don't, right? In most environments, you don't identify. What you do is, as soon as you have a problem, you file a ticket that says the network's busted. And no one in the application team is going to first look at the application. The first thing they're going to say is it's a network problem. And then, of course, the networking team spends the next several hours trying to figure out, is my WAN link choked? Is my data center network busted? Is my load balancer busted? What's going on? And then after about 4 or 5 hours, they prove, nope, the network's not the problem. And then people start looking at the application. So how do you short circuit that entire finger pointing exercise where everybody believes the network is the issue? The way you do that is by building in tremendous amounts of real-time telemetry capabilities within the load balancers themselves. It makes sense, right? When you put an application behind a load balancer, 100% of the traffic going to that application flows through the load balancer. What a beautiful point to do all your analytics, to really look at deeply, how is the application responding? How is the overall performance? Where are my problems? Is there a security issue? So it's such a fantastic and strategic point for you to answer those questions. And yet, load balancers today do not take advantage of that at all because they don't have the ability to capture all that data, process it, and provide insights. By doing the distributed architecture that we did, we're able to collect that telemetry, send it back to the controller, and within the controller is an amazing real-time network analytics engine that then processes that information in real-time, billions of metrics every hour that we can process, and then answer questions like, oops, the application's response time has gone up, even though the WAN characteristics have not changed, the data center network is fine, all the latencies, client RTTs, server RTTs, transit times are all beautiful, but the application response time just went from an average of 30 milliseconds to 3 seconds. So yes, people are going to complain about this application's performance, and no, it's not a network problem. It's actually an application issue. Let's go talk to the app guys. So we're able to do that. And based on these insights, provide the right guidance around what to scale and when. And our customers love this. They call it a reduction of MTTI or mean time to innocence or network.
And so this idea of horizontal scale, this idea of if my VIP is running on this instance and this instance is overloaded, so I just spawn another instance adjacent to it and the load is shared around. If I'm doing deep analytics, then I'm also incurring processing load. True?
Very true.
The horizontal scaling becomes doubly important if I'm relying on the analytics features, because now I need to attribute more CPU to the analytics. But if there's one thing I've learned in 20 years of building .com front ends, you can't have too much analytics in the network because it's normally just invisible and there's no way to measure performance over the internet. We're just seeing the arrival of companies now who do holistic sort of internet-based. The load balancer is one place of control where you do actually see everything and you're already doing deep packet inspection as part of the load balancing decision.
Yeah,
right?
Here's how people do inspection today. I mean, as you know, you put down the load balancer. The load balancer does DPI. It goes into layer 7. It looks at all this richness of information, makes a forwarding decision, and boom, throws everything out. And then you put a tap behind. You capture all of these packets, and then you redo all that parsing, go through all the packets, look at all the RTTs, look at all the latency information, if you're lucky enough to have it, and then provide some insight. It's insane. And so by having the distributed architecture, what that allows us to do is load balancers are already parsing through all that information. Instead of throwing this away, just don't throw it away. Ship it instead to the controller. So the net impact on your load balancing performance is damn near zero. In fact, it's probably sub 1% because you're already parsing the packet. The only additional thing you're doing is you're throwing it away. Take it and send it to the controller. So maybe one additional packet that you're introducing offline, not even in the data path. And once it goes to the controller, now you're away from the network. You're not impacting data plane performance, and the controller can now process all that information and provide insights into it. So it's really the distributed architecture with the central control and the controller not being in data path that allows us to do that incredible real-time analytics on that traffic.
There's so many questions to ask here. One thing we got to dig into is though is performance. So we've talked a lot about scaling out and gaining performance in that way, but you also mentioned, hey, we're primarily a software company. That's what we do. So I'm going to read between the lines here. Your software is going to run on x86, and you're not going to be making a big deal about hardware offload. Is that fair?
That's very fair. And I got to say, we get two questions in every initial customer meeting that we have. And the number one question we get is performance, because this is a myth that's been propagated over the last 10, 20 years that, oh boy, you need performance, you need dedicated hardware. And so please buy my box. And this continues to this day. In fact, if you look at some of our competitors in their latest refresh over the last few months, the headline is constantly, oh, look, I have this new special box that can do a million TPS or some number like that. Now, here's the fun little reality sort of check. If you walk into Facebook's data center today, if you walk into Google's data center today, if you walk into any web scale company's data center today, are you going to find big, monolithic, mainframe-like, dedicated hardware load balancers in the middle of the data center? The answer obviously is no.
Well, I see where you're going here, because we're talking about scaling out. So we're talking about all these little instances being there. You don't have to have massive hardware and special hardware offload to keep up with the load that's being put through that one big massive bit of iron, because you've just spread the load out all over the place. And actually, now that we're thinking about this, I mean, x86 has come kind of a long way. I mean, SSL offload used to be a big deal, but now that's getting more and more efficient in modern CPU architectures. So what sort of throughput do you get? I mean, are there any benchmarks that you can share with people?
Absolutely, and I'd love to. This is the other remarkable thing that has happened. Thanks to Moore's Law and some of the native SSL and encryption-related instructions that Intel has put in generic x86, every x86 CPU that goes into your environment today, the numbers we can get out of just standard x86 boxes are so incredible. A single core. Now, if you walk into your data center today, you'll probably see these 1U servers. They generally speaking have, for the most part, about 2 sockets, and each one of those sockets has somewhere between, I would say, in a modern server, 8 to perhaps 16 cores or so. So you could have about 16 or 20 cores in a box, or you could have about 30, 32, maybe even 36 cores in a box. So that's about the range that you can find in a standard x86 server. In one core, you can get something like 2,500 SSL TPS and over 5 gig of throughput out of that core today.
Again, out of a core that's in that box, not out of the box.
Just one core. So here's how incredible that is. That means out of a single generic, you know, a Dell box or even a Supermicro box, a 2-socket server which costs you maybe $5,000, you can get about 60, 70, 80,000 SSL TPS. Most enterprises don't even need that, by the way, unless you're, you know, maybe there's maybe 1,000 enterprises worldwide that need more than that. So, you know, 50, 60, 70,000 SSL TPS and several tens of gigs of overall throughput out of that single box, which costs you $5,000. A similar dedicated hardware device from an appliance vendor is going to set you back by $100,000 to $200,000. That's how incredible that performance is. That's just the scale up portion. You can continue to scale that out by having more and more, you know, quote unquote, service engines in this environment, and perhaps hundreds of these servers all performing load balancing. Our shipping software today can do about 12 million SSL TPS and about 4 terabits of overall throughput in that fabric. That makes it the world's most scalable performant load balancing fabric ever, and almost by an order of magnitude as compared to our next nearest competitor. So x86 performance, thanks to distributed software, has gone up so incredibly that, like I said earlier, most web scale companies simply do not use dedicated hardware for things like SSL offload. You can do SSL offload for cents on the dollar when you do software on top of standard x86.
But is Avi bottlenecked in some way if you're like running on top of Open vSwitch or just any virtual switch that maybe you'd be tied into its performance numbers to get your own? Or are you separate from that in some way?
You're absolutely right. If the underlying substrate, let's say OVS or another virtual switch, has certain performance limitations, perhaps on packets per second, which is probably the most common limitation we run into in terms of underlying substrates, then yes, we would be exposed to that. So what we did was, about a year ago, we introduced two concepts in our software that completely bypassed those limitations. The first one, we said, you know what? Our customers should be able to spin up our software on just standard Linux operating system running on standard x86 box. We call it our bare metal service engines. You can run it like you would run an F5 or a Netscaler or another load balancer, except rather than dedicated hardware, you're using standard x86 servers. So you can do that, and that way there's no underlying OVS or another virtual switch. The second thing that we introduced was SRIV with hypervisor bypass. So you can actually expose the underlying physical interfaces directly into our service engines, which means, again, you're not exposed to any limitations of underlying software or virtual switches. So you can get native hardware performance, extremely high performance software, without having to deploy any dedicated hardware devices in your data center.
Now, you said SRIOV. You didn't say DPDK. Is there, are you guys drawing a line between those two?
We do use DPDK internally within our service engines. Generally speaking, I don't highlight that to our customers only because it's not a separate component that they have to worry about or install and so on. We take care of all of that complexity. Once you point us to a server, we will download our software to the server and run it. And yes, there's DPDK internally running. We are even configuring things like SRIOV, but our customers don't have to worry about that. They just brought up a standard x86 server with Linux, pointed our controller to it, and we can convert it in about 30 seconds into an extremely high-performance load balancer.
Yeah, exactly. That's how you're doing the software bypass, if you will, to get the hardware performance. But that's incidental on the part of the customer. The box is just performant, but they don't have to do anything magical or turn on any switches to make it go.
Exactly right. And tomorrow, if there's another technology that allows us to get even more juice out of that underlying x86, we'll absolutely adopt it immediately. The big thing for us is, A, x86 is tremendously performant for these kind of functions today, and B, by taking that approach, you can take advantage of Moore's Law. I have customers, believe it or not, who bought a software 2 years ago, okay? 2 years ago, they deployed our software in the data center. And over time, as their servers became more and more performant thanks to Moore's Law, the performance of our own software has gone up by 2x over the last 2 years. Zero work that we did. It's the same software build that they were running 2 years ago. They just happen to be running on newer cores and newer servers. And
newer,
they get
and
twice
the
drivers
and. And the actual operating systems are improving over time as well. That's the software
exactly.
Dividend. Software sometimes gets worse, but generally it gets better.
Yeah, how well incredible is that? I mean, if you buy a box today, a load balancer, and you put it in your data center, it's a 10 gig load balancer doing X, you know, some SSL TPS. 5 years from now, it's going to be doing exactly that, if you're lucky, of course.
I was going to say it'd be doing worse.
Yeah, you're probably doing worse thanks to all the crud that collects on that box. But in our case, it is so refreshing that our customers call us back in a couple of years and say, boy, the performance just went up because I'm using newer servers and newer Linux builds or newer version of ESX, and the performance just shot up 25%. And we're like, yeah, that's great, isn't it? And so it's so refreshing that once you make a fundamental architectural decision to go with standard x86, you can take advantage of all the goodness that Intel and operating system vendors are putting in into their software rather than having to upgrade your boxes every 3 to 4 years.
Guru, we've talked a lot about performance, scaling out, and how you get in the numbers. We've talked about management, how you handle all these scaled out small load balancers with a central controller. We haven't talked about fancy features. So a lot of folks that are managing load balancers today are used to having things like layer 7 inspection and rewrite rules where they can do fancy HTTP manipulation and these sorts of things. I mean, really get right into the packets and manipulate payloads based on a whole bunch of criteria, maybe having a customized scripting language that gives them those abilities. Do we have the same kinds of abilities here?
Yeah, what a great question. So remember I said I get two questions every customer meeting. The first one is performance. The second one is features, because you very rightly pointed out these are amazingly powerful devices. They don't just, I mean, we call it load balancing, but God, I mean, that's the last thing they do. They do DPI. They look at layer 7 rules. They do web application firewalling. They do global server load balancing. They give you the ability to almost magically look at packets and say, oh, I see an SSN. Let me just replace the social security number with XXXXXXX. You can do this stuff with these devices. These are not network switches. They're amazing, intelligent devices. So our customers expect from us that when we walk in and we say, you need to move to a web scale architecture, a more modern software that can allow you to provision faster, save money, and do all that goodness, they expect table stakes that we'll be able to do all those features. So our software, not just today, but for over the last couple of years, since day one that we've been shipping, it does layer 4 load balancing. It does layer 7 load balancing, which means content switching. It does acceleration functions like compression and content caching. It does deep packet inspection. So you can look in and write scripts to look into packets and manipulate those packets and change things inside those packets. It does global server load balancing, so you can direct traffic in an intelligent way across data centers or maybe distribute it between your on-prem data center and AWS based on cost in real time. We allow our customers to do auto-scaling capabilities, like I pointed out earlier. So on that feature and functions metric, we go now toe-to-toe with our competitors in this field. Now, I will be the first one to admit that it would be wrong of me to say that for software that has been developed over the last 5 or 6 years, it has every single feature that an F5 or a NetScaler does. It doesn't, right? If you have Microsoft Exchange 2003 that you've rolled out into your data center, you're looking for a great load balancer for that, you know, we might not be able to meet every single needs of that application. So we took a view about 4 or 5 years ago and said, applications that are getting rolled out into data centers today and going forward, we need to be able to support all of those. But if you go back and you're looking for a feature that is ideally suited for an application that was written 10, 20 years ago, we might not be the best solution. The one thing I will say, I'm very proud of our engineering team, where in the few instances that we do run into these situations where a customer says, boy, I love everything, but I do need these 4 features, we're able to go back and say, okay, here's when I can get you these. The first one in 2 weeks, the next one in 4 weeks, and so on and so forth. And if the customer is okay with that, we'll go back and hit those timelines. So net-net, we follow the 80-20 rule. We have all of the features that an enterprise load balancer, enterprise class load balancer should have today. But the few that we don't, we tend to be extremely responsive to our customers and develop those in almost real time in response to their demand.
Something else popped in my head as I was thinking about the ability to scale up and scale down individual load balancers. And that is lifecycle management, including licenses specifically. Do I have to license all of these instances? How does that work?
You're going to laugh. I have been on calls with procurement in enterprise IT where the procurement people have turned around to us and said, can I take your slides on how you license and show these to our existing vendor? It's incredible. So one of the things we wanted to do, this is my 4th startup, and one of the things that I really personally wanted to do was not just develop great technology, but also a great business. I wanted to change how we treat our customers. I want them to be my partners. I want to license the software, which is ideally suited for their consumption model. So what we did do is when we came up with a version of the licensing model, we said, you know what, no node lock licenses. You should be able to purchase essentially capacity for us that lives in the controller. You can allocate it as and move it around as and when you wish, wherever you need it. So all licensing is centralized in the controller. The controller almost will, in real time, of course, extend that capacity to various load balances in the environment. If you need to burst beyond that, you can do that. A, we don't enforce that licensing because, of course, Saturday morning, 2 a.m., when you need that capacity, you shouldn't be worried about, boy, do I have to, who do I call now to get capacity? So we're very sensitive to our customers' needs, so we don't enforce that. But also, if you don't want to do something like a true up later on, you can buy what we call burst points from us, where imagine being a retailer and having these burst points at your disposal. So in the middle of the night or for a particular week when you're running a campaign, you can just artificially boost the capacity of your fabric so that you can scale as needed.
Well, you could scale for a month or so. So if you're a retailer, you could scale for December, January yep. sort of time frame. November for Cyber Monday, Cyber Friday, whatever it's called this year.
Yeah.
And then for Christmas, you could just have it running at peak for that load and then down your licensing for the rest of the year.
That's right. Imagine what this does in a number of industries, especially in retail. These guys buy 10 times their average need, the average need, right? Because as you know, as you rightly pointed out, they buy for peak and they buy for actually 2 to 3 times peak. One of the largest payment companies on the planet is our customer last year, not this past year, but the year before that. In the middle of, I think it was Thanksgiving weekend, they had unexpected capacity needs. They also got hit with a DDoS attack and their existing load balancing vendor. Of course, the appliances just keeled over and died, and they had a 15-minute outage, losing millions. And they got the x86 and the scale-out religion right after that, and they reached out to us. And they said, and this guy, I remember distinctly being in the meeting. You know what he said? He said, this is a powerful guy, you know, well-feared in that community, certainly within that company. And he goes, I can press a button and get access to 100 physical servers in 30 seconds or less. And yet, when I need a new load balancer, it takes us 6 weeks? That's insane. Yeah. And he was like, that's it. No more hardware load balancers. We're done with this stuff. I need software in here. Those are the kind of environments where this notion of being able to burst on demand, this notion of being able to consume licenses in real time only and as when you need it, this is a very powerful commercial notion. So it's not just a technical decision, but even commercially, we're enabling our customers to save massively on not having to bill for peak.
Now, let me just expound on something. There's a thing here that I think we might have missed, which is because you're software focused, whether bare metal, container, VM, you can work just as easily in the public cloud as you can in the private cloud, can't you?
Yep. I call this notion of consistency. And here's normally how our conversations with some of our customers go. You introduce your technology and you mention that you can have a consistent experience in a consistent way of offering elastic load balancing, both on-prem as well as in public cloud, in AWS, in Azure, in Google Cloud. And the light bulb goes off and they're like, guru, I can barely keep hold of my teams to have them become experts on an F5 or a NetScaler. I can't go back to these guys who are already underwater and now ask them to become experts in some public cloud load balancing technology as well. I can barely keep up with one. How am I going to do it with two or three? So this notion of a consistent fabric that provides elastic load balancing in all of my public clouds and on-prem, all the way back to perhaps bare metal appliances sitting in front of my mainframes, this is extremely powerful and allows me to really leverage that learning, one-time learning, across all of these disparate environments. So that notion is becoming very, very powerful. And quite frankly, you've probably noticed this too. In the last 1 year, I've seen just a massive, massive increase in interest in public cloud within Global 2000 Enterprise. And so we have customers today who use us from a central controller. They use us to provide elastic load balancing in AWS, as well as bare metal in front of completely traditional workloads, all from a single console.
I think that's the thing, is that single console, public cloud, private cloud, your data center, someone else's data center, however you want to see it, you know, colo, blah, 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 but it runs on x86. So if you're renting servers in Azure or AWS, you can run your load balancers there and not have to reskill to some platform. It's all just same interface, same process, same thinking. I think that's important.
Really, really important. Yeah. And so two things happened, right? One, the word you used, I love that word, reskill. So no reskilling here, right? No learning 4 or 5 different technologies. And two, this is sort of the corollary to this, where the networking team is no longer the villain. You know what happens today, right? So somebody walks up and says, hey, man, I'm going to deploy a Kubernetes cluster or OpenShift in Azure. Can you support me from a load balancing perspective? And the poor networking admin is like, I'm not so sure, man. I need to go back and take this class again on my F5s. and then, you know, I'll go take in a class on Azure and then OpenShift. No, no, none of that. These guys are heroes now because they can sit there and go, you're deploying containers? Not a problem. Yes, I can.
The problem with, oh, you're doing the it problem in with Azure? Being a speed bump is you get driven over all the time.
Yeah.
And that's it's not very pleasant.
Yeah.
So now, just to sort of take this a step further, because your controller is, well, it's a controller, right? It's software.
Yeah.
And you've got this centralized view, automation, orchestration. Have you got all that?
We spend a ton of resources here in our internal engineering team to understand every environment that we could be deployed into, perhaps as simple as vCenter and virtual environment or OpenStack or a container environment with Kubernetes or Mesosphere or something like that, or perhaps a public cloud. So what we do with that understanding is natively, we teach our controller how to talk to these environments. So for instance, the controller can talk to vCenter. When you're running out of capacity in the middle of the night, I don't need to send you a page to bring more load balancers online. The controller will automatically detect there's a performance issue. The issue is not because of your application, not because of the underlying network. It's because we are running out of load balancing capacity. So the controller will talk to vCenter, spin up a service engine, connect it to the right port groups, all in real time, place additional applications onto that, send out the grad ARPs all in real time, and within seconds, you've got a bigger, better load balancer. It can do the same in AWS, in your container offering, in OpenShift, in OpenStack, in all of these environments. And that's what takes away all of this sort of, you know, minutiae and busy work of having to figure out how do I add capacity, how do I provision a load balancer, how do I connect it to the right networks, how do I distribute the VIPs better across the 100 load balancer that I have, and so on. Mm-hmm.
So you're not doing that mentally. You might be integrating with OpenStack or Mesosphere or Kubernetes, you know, whatever makes you happy.
That's exactly right. So that's a one-time task. You deployed OpenStack, not a problem. Point our controller to OpenStack, we'll take care of the rest. And suddenly within OpenStack, you've got what the OpenStack community calls LBAS, or Load Balancing as a Service. So basically, you've just spun up an Elastic Load Balancer within OpenStack. You can do the same within your vCenter cluster. You can do the same within your AWS instance. So very powerful, almost magical ability to provide Elastic Load Balancing and self-service into these environments just because we natively integrate with the management and orchestration systems that our customers are deploying today.
Well, it's interesting that that also takes out that reskilling concern because it just integrates into your orchestration platform. So you don't have to worry about reskilling because you're not going to be spending a lot of time by hand spinning these things up. It's been automated.
Very true. Somebody's running through your data center going, hey, man, we just standardized an OpenShift. And you're like, oh, boy, that's another four-hour class I need to take to figure out what's going on. No, just point it to your OpenShift cluster and we'll take care of the rest. So again, a very powerful way of enabling networking teams to do more without having to go back and reskill and without being the speed bumps that, as you rightly pointed out, tend to get run over.
How's the IPv6 support on an Avi Networks Guru?
Much like any other load balancer, our customers expect us to do that. So it's in beta right now. We do V6 to V4, V4 to V6. As gateways, we also do native V6, both in management and data plane. We should be shipping that over the next few months. Betas are going along really well.
Guru, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, because we were making the point that, hey, the load balancer sees all these applications that are going through and is doing all of this deep layer 7 packet decodes in many cases, and therefore knows a lot about what's going on. And the reporting that you can get from that and the decisions that the load balancer can make about what's going on, helping you to pinpoint the actual source and root cause of problems and so on. How deep does that go? Is it really just load balancer centric, that data, or can I actually mine that data and go more deeply into that?
We collect not just data around the load balancing piece, but also on application performance. We collect data on security overall, your security posture, as well as from a DDoS perspective or security attack perspective, what's going on. And then we finally collect data on end user experience for people who are coming into your websites. What are the page load times? What is the overall latency? Are they having a good time or not? Are they likely to complain or not? So a ton of data on both sides of the load balancer, on the end user side, the end user experience, as well as on the application side, application performance. And then, of course, the metadata around availability and security. Is the application available? How is it responding? Does it have a secure stance? Are you seeing a DDoS attack, et cetera? So a ton of data that is so useful now that it probably wouldn't surprise you. When we go back and talk to our customers who've been in production for a few quarters, perhaps, I find parts of that data that we collect on knock screens now. Because they want to understand for every application that they deploy, how is the application responding? And when it's not responding quickly, is it a network problem or an application problem, or is it because we're getting hit with a DDoS attack and so on? That ability to get those tremendous amounts of insights on both sides, on the user side and application side, without, and this is the key, without having to deploy any agents, without having to deploy any probes or monitoring fabrics or third-party devices for visibility and network insights, without having to do any of that, just because you put a load balancer in front of the app, something which you were going to do anyway, now you're getting all these insights. That's very powerful.
Well, it's an interesting alternative to what you would typically do with, say, an application performance monitoring, where you build a set of synthetic transactions and build a dependency tree and then try to come up with some kind of a custom screen that you could put on the NOC to give you indication of your status and so on of your critical applications. I mean, you're telling me people are actually using this in the NOC, which is interesting. I was trying to think of a scenario where I'd seen load balancer screens used in a NOC, and mostly it would be like red light, green light, virtual IP availability, that kind of thing, not performance typically.
And here's the best part, right? So when you're sitting in a NOC and you're looking at these screens, not only are we providing that real-time insight, but the controller itself now also becomes sort of like a DVR. It's a network DVR, right? So you can go back and you can say, well, yesterday at 9 a.m., who were all the people who were hitting my website? And so you can go through those logs. You can figure out, well, between yesterday and today, what is the distribution between people who were coming in from mobile versus laptops, Windows versus Mac? Or iPhones versus Android phones. You can do all this analysis in real time, but you can also go back and replay the events that have been happening over the last several weeks in your environment and understand how the application's performance has been changing. So that's very powerful. The other thing is this then has secondary impact into your environment. The first one, of course, is you can imagine troubleshooting becomes a lot easier, and we have real data now that we are able to shave 3 to 4 hours off ticket resolution times when it comes to, you know, networking issues. But it also has an impact on how quickly you can bring applications online. You don't have to tell the application guy, well, I can provision the load balancer right now, but you got to give me 2 more days before I can turn on a span port and capture this data and send it to my network-based APM and then provide you the insights into what's going on. You don't have to do that. It's instantaneous provisioning of not just the load balancing fabric, but also the insights fabric in some sense, along with that application. So that has then impact on provisioning times. It has impact on the cost, of course, because you no longer have to deploy the secondary products. So that's where we see the big hit when customers move to our architecture. It's not just faster provisioning, but it's also deeper insights, which has real-world impact on reducing resolution times and reducing the cost of your monitoring environment.
But it's just funny to me the context in which you put this, because you just made the point right up front. Look, this box is in the middle of these applications already. Why wouldn't you provide this information? And now that I'm thinking about it that way, it's like, yeah, that is kind of obvious. It is obvious and useful that you've baked that functionality into the platform. Now, one more question I got for you, Guru, is going back to performance one more time. Sorry, I keep beating it to death, but have you guys pushed the system to some sort of theoretical limit, you know, or scaled it up really high where you can put some ridiculous number of transactions through it? Because, I mean, in theory, we can talk about scaling out and, you know, lots of little load balances all day and 5 gigabits per second on a core and so on. But how big can you actually go?
You know, let me just put this to rest with a story, something that happened here about 4 or 5 weeks ago. So I talked about that one of the largest payment companies on the planet that's our customer. So they came over to us and they're adopting public cloud in a big way. And they said, you know what, I'm worried if we can scale in the public cloud, both their applications and, of course, our load balancing fabric. And we said, okay, what numbers are you trying to hit? And he said about, for this app, about 200,000 to 300,000 SSL TPS. That's net new 200,000 to 300,000 incoming SSL connections, net new, right? So we said, okay, let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. So this was in Google Cloud. One of our engineers, the lead engineer for Google Cloud, hops on his console, and we start deploying more service engines, our version of load balancers. So we deploy the first service engine, the second one, the third one. He writes a small script, and he starts scaling SSL TPS. In about 10 minutes, he's got about 30 or 40 service engines up in Google Cloud. He's using ECMP to distribute incoming traffic across those for one app, for one VIP. So he's using ECMP. Traffic is coming in. He's hitting these service engines, and he hits about 1 million SSL TPS, about 4 times what the customer needed. 1 million SSL TPS in about 10 minutes on Google Cloud. And then he, of course, gradually shuts this all down in a very graceful way. The entire exercise takes us about 20 minutes. The customer is super happy. My favorite part of the story, to get to that 1 million SSL TPS, this engineer then, it took him about $30. about $30 to fire this entire system up, get those service engines online, the backend clients, servers, all of that traffic that needed to be generated and served, all of this, this entire sandbox was up and running and gone in about 20 or 30 minutes, cost us about $30, all for a single app, a single VIP. Think about that. A million SSL TPS load balancer in the market.
And normally that would take you multiple hard boxes with blah, 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 and power and rack space, and you're doing it.
Yeah, and $1 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, is there $30?
Yeah, it's a project, and it's a forklift, and it's 15 engineers, yeah.
A figurative, not a literal necessarily, but I'll go with it. I'll go with it, yeah.
So that's how incredible the scale and performance of distributed fabrics can be. And I think that example should illustrate why some of these, you know, massive global companies, as they adopt public cloud, or certainly even within their own data center, as the needs of applications continue to grow from a performance and scale perspective, they're rapidly moving away from these single point of failures, massive scale-up architectures, custom devices, to distributed scale-out architectures with software like the ones that we ship.
Well, Guru, if folks are interested in learning more about Avi Networks, how can they reach out to you guys?
Well, we're always online on Twitter at Avi Networks. Of course, if you'd like to chat with us in person or reach out to us, you can always hit us up on our website at www.avinetworks.com or on LinkedIn, or quite frankly, at most industry conferences. We dutifully head over to Cisco Live. We're going to be there at Cisco Live Berlin in a few weeks. We're going to be at the OpenStack Summit in Boston, at OSCON. We go to VMworld. We go to DockerCon and a number of container conferences. So you should be able to get a hold of us, certainly online or in person. I would highly recommend hitting us up in person at one of these conferences if your listeners are going to be there. There is nothing more powerful, nothing, no amount of talk is a substitute for actually seeing the product live and experiencing what a phenomenal modern architecture can do from a visibility, analytics, insights perspective, or in terms of your ability to take care of applications in a more agile fashion and respond quickly to incoming demands.
And Guru, are you social personally? Do you blog or tweet, anything like that?
You know, I do. I tend to be pretty active on Twitter at Guru Chahal, at GuruChahal, at Guru Chahal on Twitter. I blog sometimes on avinetworks.com, but quite frankly, you don't want to read my blogs. What you want to do is read our CTO's blogs. Those are incredible. I'm an engineer by training and a technologist, and I salivate every time he uploads something. You definitely want to hit those. My Twitter account, you know, it's a mixed bag. It's a combination of stories about my kids and technology.
Sounds like my Twitter account.
Well, I can't match you, Greg, on Snark, but I tell you, I come pretty close.
Okay. Well, speaking of Snark, Mr. Banks, you know how I feel about software appliances, don't you? And this just seems to fit right into that model of the idea of running custom hardware with software on top of that custom hardware. And that's, the software's not custom. It's most of the appliances that are out there today are x86. This sort of stuff makes perfect sense to me. I think it's worth checking it out.
Yeah, it does. It's the same. And I'll put in a chip for if you're at one of these conferences, go see the interface in person. I have actually done that, seen the Avi interface in person, and it's very intuitive, easy to use. I don't think you'd be disappointed by the interface whatsoever. So definitely worth the visit to the Avi Networks booth if you're heading out, for instance, to Cisco Live Europe, where I'm going to be in just a few weeks as part of a Tech Field Day delegation. Our thanks to Avi for sponsoring the show today, and our thanks to you for listening. If you do visit Avi, please let them know you found out about them from Packet Pushers. And you can find this and many of our fine free technical podcasts all at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. We are also on LinkedIn, Facebook, iTunes, etc. Give us a rating on iTunes. We would really appreciate that. Last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.